I guess we'll get started here. My name is Ivan Eland, and I'm the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty here at the Independent Institute, and I'll be the moderator tonight. We have two distinguished speakers here tonight that are going to speak at this program called The Promised Land of the Free. This evening we're featuring the book Skepticism and Freedom by Richard Epstein, and of course you can get that upstairs. If you haven't already, you should get a copy of it. Before we get started, I'd just like to make one mention of an upcoming Independent Institute event. In your packets and on our website, you're going to find information about our forthcoming dinner. On April 21st, we'll be holding a gala dinner event entitled Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and the Global Marketplace, featuring Robert Galvin, Chairman Emeritus of Motorola Corporation, and Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal. Now I'm going to keep my introductory remarks very short tonight, so we have the maximum time for our speakers in the Q&A following. But I'll just say that over the past century, U.S. government power has grown astronomically as the average citizen's life is increasingly taxed, regulated, and spied upon. In the last few years alone, federal spending has increased almost 30%, creating the largest deficit in U.S. history and an extensive corporate welfare pork and abuses of civil liberties and also economic liberties.
Are you running the Bush campaign?
I don't think you're going to find too much support here for that. But
from me?
Even in the non-security spending, President Bush has increased spending faster than any president since Lyndon Johnson. So the spigots are turned on, so to speak. In his new work, Richard Epstein goes to the root of the problem, addressing moral, conceptual, and psychological foundations of liberty and showing how they have been systematically undermined in the U.S. Should individuals be free to make their own peaceful choices, or should decisions by special interests in the name of the public good be imposed by force? What about property rights, taxes, regulations, civil rights? We are delighted to have the two speakers here tonight, and I'll introduce Richard Epstein first. He's the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, and he's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. In addition to Skepticism and Freedom, just hold up the book one more time there. He's also written Simple Rules for a Complex World, Principles for a Free Society, and Takings, Private Property, and the Power of Eminent Domain. And he is the co-editor of The Vote, Bush, Gore, and the Supreme Court. And he's also published articles for Wall Street Journal and New York Times and many other publications. And I was told today that his book Takings was featured in the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing. Is that correct?
I'll give the whole speech about that.
Okay, now, and I'm going to introduce both speakers so we can get right to the program here. Our second speaker is Jeffrey Rogers Hummel. He's a professor of economics at San Jose State, and he's also a national fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's author of the book Emancipating Slaves and Enslaving Free Men, A History of the American Civil War. Now, obviously, we're not going to be speaking specifically about the Civil War tonight, but this is an excellent book because I've read it myself, and so I can commend it to everyone. Professor Hummel also wrote the scripts for the audio program, The United States Constitution, narrated by Walter Cronkite, and the audio series American Wars, narrated by George C. Scott. So I'm going to turn it over to Professor Epstein, and you have
okay.
A mic here.
Well, thank you, Ivan. I have to say, it really is a great pleasure to be invited here by David and by Ivan, and to spend some more time with Jeff when we share Hoover appointments. And it's always nice to have an audience which is here, alert, and mildly sympathetic to some of the things that I'm about to say. Actually, I was going to get very annoyed at David because I thought he double-crossed me. That is, when I walked in, I realized, oh my God, this title about the Promised Land, that's Nicholas Lemann's book and so forth. And I said, I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to say about it. But if the Lord taketh away on the one hand, he delivereth in the other, and Ivan has come to the rescue. Because what he did is, in fact, he reminded me of an episode which has long been forgotten in my life, which was the way in which before Anita Hill, I was the hottest thing on Capitol Hill during the Thomas hearings. Now, it actually relates to this particular talk. When I was a young man, I wrote this book called Takings, and I realized that I had become, quite by inadvertence, almost accidentally, almost against my will, a crusader against virtually every major trend in judicial thought in the United States in the last 100 years. And as I mentioned to somebody beforehand, I was writing this book and I was worried about all these fine questions about, for example, do you recover consequential damages in a takings case? And all of you were looking at me and said, I don't even understand the problem, professor. So why the hell should I worry about the answer? And, you know, they were small bore issues, but they all matter. And around page 322 of this book, I came to the conclusion, quite by surprise to the author, that's me, that the entire New Deal structure was unconstitutional. I said, this is not, and I just sort of wrote it out. I mean, the important stuff had to do with these consequential damage cases, and this was a minor point which was sufficiently unsubtle that it didn't require a lot of elaboration. I didn't realize that when people would actually look at this book, they would care about its major thesis and not about its conceptual foundations, and this became very clear during the Thomas hearings. Clarence Thomas is something of a natural lawyer, and for those of you who don't know what that dirty phrase turns out to mean, it basically has the sense that individuals have, by their creator or by some other natural force, you're not quite sure which, rights to their person, rights to acquire property, rights to sell their labor in ordinary transactions, and rights to be free from the interference of others, and that to the extent that you have state coercion with respect to these kinds of liberties, it has to be done to benefit the very people who are going to be coerced. So what our friend John Locke, who was the leading naturalist, said in these terms was, sure, you can tax people, but you have to tax them in a way which returns to them benefits in the form of security, which is greater than the liberty that you ask them to sacrifice. And that's a situation in which it's kind of a coercive form of winning behavior with respect to the individuals in question. And, you know, I, as a young man, read that, thought it sounded rather good, realized later on that it actually had some fairly powerful economic foundations associated with it, and midway through this book on takings, I had figured this out. Now, what does this get you in terms of political purchase? Well, the answer really is extraordinarily simple, and I'm sorry to say, not entirely edifying. What happens is Senator Joe Biden, who did go to the University of Syracuse Law School, I think, and finished last in his class, became the leading constitutional critic of his generation. And what he did, in effect, is he picked up a copy of my takings book, which I wish I had here, and on national television showed it to a somewhat puzzled Justice Thomas in waiting, and said, sir, if you believe anything which is contained in this book, you are not fit to sit on the United States Supreme Court. That was the sort of the nice message about this. And I mean, you know, it turned out that he was even willing to give me equal time. If I was prepared to go into this kind of rigged campaign setting associated with Washington politics, one of my former students who worked for Biden said, you could come down and testify and defend yourself. And I said to him, I have a better idea because I know you won't accept my offer just as I won't accept yours, which is, you know, if Thomas lives or dies, he's going to have to fight for himself. He doesn't have to have my baggage on top of his broad shoulders. But tell the senator anytime he wants to debate about the merits of my book in front of a neutral forum in which he doesn't control both microphones simultaneously, I will be more than happy to oblige him. And you know what? It's now been counting 13 years, and I didn't even get the courtesy of a rejection with respect to the particular letter in question. And there's actually a slight moral about this, and then I will try to talk about it in relationship to these particular principles, which is what happens is there are some people who, when they are dominant politically, become a form of intellectual bully. And what I mean by that is if there's nobody in the room who's prepared to speak against them, they're willing to say rather harsh things about things that they disagree with. But on the other hand, if you pipe up and say, let's have equal time, all of a sudden they'll turn, run, and hide. And I think the one thing I'm most proud about in my academic career is I've never turned down a debate on anything with anybody. And it seems to me that that's the right attitude that you have to have with respect to your own work. If you really believe in it, you have to believe it in front of your friends in this room, and you have to be prepared to go into settings which are much more hostile and tell exactly the same thing, so that if your worst detractor and your best friend come together, they will each agree that you've said whatever it was that you said, even though they will disagree about the wisdom and sobriety of all the thoughts that you have put forward. Now, that being said, the question, as we start to slowly elaborate this riff, is quite simply this. What was it about what I said that made somebody like Joe Biden so terribly upset about everything that I believe? And essentially what it was a story, not a betrayal, because I'm not one who likes to point fingers at people who disagree with me, but rather a story of people who've lost their way and failed to understand the kinds of principles under which our particular nation was put together. And as I mentioned to you already, you know, in terms of my political origins, I'm very much somebody who thought that John Locke had an odd good idea too, and that interestingly enough that many of the founding fathers, when they put this government together, actually thought more or less about the same thing. And the central question that they had to face, since they were not anarchists and they weren't even strong libertarians, they were sort of more sober classical liberals. So the difference between the libertarian and the classical liberal actually matters, although in terms of current policy debates, we're always on the same side, so we tend to forget these differences between us. But the argument turns out to be this. The Lockean position, as I said, understood the power of individual self-ownership with respect to labor, understood the power of the ability to sell your services to somebody who wants them and not to somebody who doesn't want them, which is the usual government way of doing business, understands the power of situations where, since we all don't agree about what each other should do, we're all entitled to take offense at what others do, but not entitled to stop them by virtue of the fact that we have offense. But on the other hand, when they put their hands in your face, you can gently remove it in order to go about your way. And that sort of simple set of accommodations is the set of accommodations under which, for the most part, government ought to satisfy. Now, the standard difficulty with this Lockean formation is, in fact, one that every serious government has to face, whether it be a simple republic or a compound republic or federalist society like the one that we have. And the question that you have to ask is, this particular system of rights self-supporting without any kind of central authority in order to deal with it? And the Lockean answer, which I think we all accept, is self-help remedies are nice, but in a general situation, they're not going to be sufficient to maintain order, because self-help can not only be exercised by those people who in fact have been wrong, it can also be exercised by those people who wish to commission wrong and to commit wrongs. And so therefore, what you have to do in any political order is to find an impartial umpire whom you put on top of them who can adjudicate these disputes. Once you commit yourself to that position, you realize that you've done a terrible thing. You've created a government monopolist of force, and then the next question you have to do is to figure out how it is that you manage to discipline this particular guy. If you were an old-fashioned Hobbesian, you'd say, that's not even worth trying. Absolute power in the hands of a sovereign is what we want, because anything else is going to be anarchy. But if you think about it a little bit more difficult, essentially what you would say in economic terms is if we invest a little bit more in government, we might be able to get rid of some of its rough edges. And that's what essentially the theory of constitutionalism is about. So the first thing you have to figure out is exactly what is it that you want this particular government to do. And, you know, we have a pretty good approximation from our own constitution. One of the things that you'd like it to do is to defend you against foreign invasions with an army and an air force and a navy, maybe not an air force back in 1789, but maybe then, who knows. We'll put that aside. So you have to do that. You have to supply some kind of a social infrastructure. I think there is a certain libertarian fantasy that you could run all sorts of network industries on a voluntary basis. But one of the things that modern economics confirms, which I think the older theorists believed in, is that the coordination problem of trying to get little pieces of highway together from millions of people means that somebody will just simply blockade the entire enterprise and the whole thing will come clattering down. So this means you got to have a system of taxes. You probably have to have a system of takings, God forbid. But for that, you want to offset it by some system of compensation so that you would never have a situation in which a single individual can be victimized by a state which would simply say that your property is exactly what we need for the public good and, oh, by the way, we'll wipe you out. The fact that you have to pay compensation as a polity to the particular individual whom you prejudice by a deprivation of property means that you're not going to have to take into account his losses when you determine your political functions and your general sense of social welfare. And since each of us has a little bit of larceny in us, it's nice to make sure that when we act in our collective behaviors, we recognize that we too can sometimes be the odd man out. And this essentially, if you start to look at our government, it is not a straight libertarian kind of situation, which is the force of the words classical liberal that I put into the title of the book. And if you're trying to figure out what the differences are, I think I would state them in the following way. A good libertarian, hard-lined and consistent, believes that all taxes are theft and therefore no taxes are allowed. A good classical liberal, of the sort that I am, takes the Lockean view that you have to have taxations to keep a union, but you'd like to keep them flat in order to simplify their administration on the one hand and to prevent people from constantly figuring out a way to tax somebody else for benefits that they receive in one form or another. So you've got to have a system of taxation. And then, of course, if you're trying to figure out what the next thing is, you also have to have a system of infrastructure, which is going to allow people who own private property to communicate one to another. In modern terms, we call this network industries, and we talk about the internet, and we talk about the roads, and we talk about the telecommunications system, and all the rest of that. And what it takes, in effect, to organize one of these networks is a little bit of coercion. And again, the system of taxation and the system of condemnation are designed to put this kind of infrastructure together. Now, if you're a very good libertarian, you don't much care about the differences between cartels on the one hand and competitive industries on the other, because both of them arise out of voluntary contracts. On the other hand, if you read that bloke named Adam Smith, you would care pretty much about this kind of difference. And he would say, generally speaking, if you put two rival cells in the same room and they start to collude on price, you better be a little bit worried, because you can trace the systematic social dislocations from monopoly, which you can't trace from competition. It's not that competition doesn't have its losers, and that monopoly doesn't have its losers. Both have losers. But what you can say about the competitive situation is you've exhausted all the gains from trade. What you cannot say about the monopoly system is exactly the same proposition. So for somebody who has a slightly more economic and a little bit less natural law view of the world, it turns out that you can say, if we can maintain it, competitive type situations turn out to dominate monopoly type situations. And so our good classical liberal is going to be allowed to tinker with the whole question of monopoly regulation. But since he looks at government always under a presumption of distrust because of the abilities of factions to take it over, he's going to examine very carefully any proposed remedy to see whether or not it is worse than any particular disease. And the last thing, which became not an 18th century issue, but surely a 19th century issue, was the central problem of the common pool. That is, there are many resources like wild animals, fish, and game, where if you allow the Lockean rules of first possession and capture to take over, in the end you cannot have sustainable supplies of various kinds of wildlife. And trying to figure out smart ways in which you could prevent the level of capture so as to allow the sustainability of the underlying resource generally requires government kinds of catch limits which cannot be explained under standard libertarian principles. And so, too, if you go look at the late 19th century cases when they were worried about the extermination of birds and the exploitation of oil fields and the development of water rights, all of these funny little materials don't lend themselves to simple private property solutions. Sometimes you require common property. Sometimes you require direct forms of government regulation. And essentially, a classical liberal is willing to specialize with those things. Now, what is it that he's going to be extremely doubtful about, given this long list of things that you're allowed to do? And I think the simplest answer is the classical liberal is always somebody who is deeply suspicious, if not outright hostile to, efforts at the covert redistribution of wealth that take place through schemes of regulation and taxation. That is, we know, in effect, that if you don't allow one person to take from A and then to give that property to B, you have to be very worried about a situation where you tax one person, take the proceeds, give those proceeds to the other fellow, and then he could buy the very property in question. Or in other words, if you really think that taking and transferring is a very difficult kind of situation, you're not going to be happy with the following scenario, which I am going to impose in order to show that I'm an honest man. Jeff, I would never want to take anything that you ever owned against your will. But on the other hand, I'm going to go to Congress sitting over here and announce that you are my debtor, so that therefore I can now sue you to collect the debt that you happen to owe me. And it turns out what we're worried about takings. We have to be worried about all these fancy little connivances that individuals can use so as to convert him from somebody who's an innocent victim into somebody who's merely paying his just debts to society, i.e. me, right? You know, these problems are extremely serious. And, you know, to our great credit in the Constitution, it turned out, for the most part, we had a series of institutions that were designed within limits to try to deal with some of these problems. When it came to the question of taxation, for example, by and large, the original Constitution tried to figure out ways in which you could stabilize the ends to which taxes could be used. And when they said that you could tax and spend for the general welfare, they did not mean that you could tax and spend for anything you're damn well pleased to spend for. They meant, in effect, that there were certain kinds of public goods of the sort that I've talked about, and that the ability to extract revenues from each citizen from which they receive in exchange their pro rata share of the public good in question was a perfectly legitimate function of government, which is very different from the situation of taking from the left side of the room in order to give something to the right side of the room on the grounds that there's slightly more people sitting on this side of the room than are sitting on that side of the room so that majority politics is able to do this. In fact, in the early Constitution, they even went one step further. They were so worried about the distribution of wealth between states that they had rules which said that poorer states had to pay a larger fraction of their local income to a common national project than the richer states so as to prevent these transfers from happening. And those restrictions, I think, have essentially disappeared, largely because people don't have the same kind of powerful identifications with states that they had elsewhere. But one of the things that then happens is, where in the Constitution do you tend to fall down? And here I'm going to introduce a fatal, dangerous, but very important word, which I think describes the failure of the judiciary to deal with the issues of the constitutional structure. And that word is deference. Generally speaking, when you start to defer to somebody else, what you're saying, in effect, is, I know you guys are doing the wrong things, but I don't have the courage to stop you. And that is, turns out to be the problem. This is not a critique which says that the courts in many ways have been too strong and have dominated the situation. They have been strong in many ways that are indefensible. But to the extent that there is a constitution which has strong property protections, powerful limitations on taxation, structures that are designed to deal with contracts and with commerce and interstate trade, it seems to me that if you're faithful to the original doctrine, you have to be faithful to this underlying Lockean vision, which by and large happened to animate. So the first question is, what do you do about progressive taxation, estate taxation, and so forth? And it didn't take the 1937 New Deal to figure out how to punt on that one. Essentially what happened is, starting in the late part of the 19th century, people made the following argument. You can imagine taxes that are so horrendous that we will treat them as confiscatory and strike them down. On the other hand, we've yet to see one, and frankly, my dear, we don't think that we ever will. And that's exactly what happened with respect to the United States. A extreme level of deference, the idea that these splendid denizens whom we elect to Congress would not put their hands in each other's pockets, was enough to say to the court they don't have to do anything. That's because they don't care about wealth. But let me now give you a situation which shows you that when judges do care, they can do things right. One of the things that our Constitution has is privileges that deal with freedom of speech. And that, of course, is a rather important topic. You've got to be able to criticize government. And, of course, governments don't like to be criticized. And one of the ways in which they'll start to stop criticism is to try to tax the people who criticize them, including newspapers and magazines. And one of the things that you're always going to try to do is to tax your critics more than your friends if you could figure out a way to skew the taxes in order to do that. And in a case involving the Minnesota Star back in the early 80s, what they did is they had a way in which they had a progressive tax dependent upon the circulation of a particular newspaper. And the same Supreme Court, which thought that progressive taxes were perfectly okay in the economic sphere, struck them down when it came to the First Amendment, about which they still care. And the explanation is one that generalizes perfectly well. You got a revenue target, you could always reach it under a flat tax. The moment you start skewing it, we have to worry about whether you're attacking your enemies in order to be able to help your friends. We're not going to limit the size of the government directly, but the moment we start to put this proration requirement on top of it, the willingness to tax is going to be much more reduced in virtue of the tax, that the tax has to be flat and the benefits have to be flat. Nobody under these circumstances, where if you keep flat benefits and flat taxes, can essentially game the system. So by a series of very elegant indirect constraints, the game theorists will confirm that you will try to vote for the optimal level of taxation. Now, I don't think they quite understood that back in 1789, but it really is, in fact, the way in which the game starts to work. So that's how the thing started to get unraveled with respect to the tax type situation. Now let's go and look at a little bit further. And we're going to start to talk about the property side of the situation. As I mentioned to you before, it is generally held that you cannot have a situation in which you take property from A and give it to B, because that's the same thing as allowing a government to essentially organize the very kinds of thefts that it's designed to prevent. Well, what do we do in order to enforce that provision? Well, the sensible thing that we ought to do, in effect, is to say that if we have the exact restriction on him in order to protect him from various kinds of deprivations, well, we have to understand if his name is Ireton, he's intrinsically unreliable, and if we stop the direct form of theft, he will try to figure out other devices that are a little bit more subtle, which will achieve much the same end. So what's friend Ivan and his cronies going to do to the virtuous Jeff on the other side of the room? Now, this is just a metaphor and an allegory, right? This is not a personal allegation. So he will understand that the only reason he is getting the criticism is because he is sitting on my left, right? If he had been sitting on my right, he would, of course, been at this point a man of perfect virtue. Now, what does this man on the left decide to do? Well, let's just take a kind of a very simple model. And I want you to conceptually expand yourself until you think of the world as a giant tic-tac-toe board. And there are 8 squares around the outside of the board, all of which have been built up by their owners. And there is a 9th square in the middle, which is now empty, which is owned by Jeff. And so now what goes on under these circumstances is we believe in democratic politics, right? And so we get the sober town people to come together, and they will now propose a moratorium which says, in perfectly neutral terms, nobody will be able to build any more on the tic-tac-toe grid. So all the guys on the outside on the 8 who've built their homes and have it exactly the way they want it agree not to build anything more, and old Jeff sitting over there, he can't build anything either. Now, what has happened in this particular situation? What's happened in this particular situation is a perfectly neutral rule has a violently disparate impact with respect to the community under which it goes. And this fellow, who knew that he couldn't take the land and use it for himself without having to pay compensation, because to the credit of the Supreme Court, if you dispossess somebody, you basically owe them top dollar. He's found a way to impose a land use restriction which gives him 90% of what he wants for a zero price, or very, very close to it. So that the 8 vote out the 1, they all manage to gain a certain amount of money, and he gets wiped out. And this essentially has the following major proposition. The United States Supreme Court, when it came to the question as to whether by judicial artifice and device you could in fact control somebody else's land through a restrictive system, said, you can do that and you don't have to pay him a dime, and let you completely wipe him out. And once you know the rule, you won't wipe old Jeff completely out. You'll just give him a little scintilla or something so as to keep the thing interesting. And in fact, that's exactly what has happened. Once the rule became exactly the way I've said it, all the states said you could always build if you could go through enough hurdles so that sometime in the next 40 years, you'll be able to complete your project. You think I'm kidding, right? Well, there have been 4 or 5 major Supreme Court cases dealing with land use restrictions of guys who haven't been allowed to build on their land, and they all have one feature in common. It's been at least 30 years since the application to build has been submitted, and there has been no positive response. And the Sweden case, the Palazzolo case has had that, the Lake Tahoe case has had that. It just is the Monterey case has had it. It's not an accident that if these 8 guys sitting over there don't have to pay anything for restricting his ability to do it, they will take into account their private function and they will ignore what happens to him. And essentially in the property area, the inability, the unwillingness, and the, shall we say, the stubbornness about insisting that land restrictions aren't restrictions on property rights has led to the rise of a zoning situation, which has probably resulted in the destruction of hundreds of millions, probably hundreds of billions of dollars of real property in the United States. There were rules which would adjudicate the boundaries between these people, and these were rules which essentially said that when you built your house, you can't build a stink factory if it's going to blow everybody else. Anti-nuisance restrictions were always part of the Constitution, the common law. They should be part of the common law as well. All right, so that's the second part of the way in which we've fallen from the promised land. How much more time do I have? And I'll figure out how many more steps we're going to decline. take all the time I need. Okay, I'll take a few more minutes. Keep it coming. All right.
A couple more minutes.
Couple more minutes. Okay, that means he's a man on the left. It's suppression of freedom of speech, right? Well, we're going to keep in line. But let me just talk about at least two other elements which are of extreme importance in trying to understand this game. As you recall, I said sort of one of the standard bundle of the quote-unquote natural rights that seems to have been part and parcel of our traditional heritage is the ability of every individual to dispose of his or her labor to other individuals in whatever ways they see fit. And I'm going to put aside a serious caveat having to deal with the application of the antitrust laws, because I will only talk about regulations which have nothing to do with the creation, perpetuation, or expansion of monopoly power. Just trying to talk about ordinary variety regulations of one kind or another. If you go back to the period between 1865 and 1937, there were a lot of technical constitutional hijinks, so that the story as a doctrinalist was not all that clear. But it was remarkably how astute these characters were in trying to figure out what the basic system of entitlements was. And their view about it was that the basic liberties that people had, protected by either the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which is the natural home, or the Due Process Clause, which was the actual home, included the right of people to dispose of their labor as they saw fit. These were rules, by the way, which had tremendous liberalizing effects. For example, they were used systematically to protect aliens against discrimination by domestic people who had the vote when the aliens in many cases did not. The most famous case on this particular sort was a case against Lochner against New York, where Lochner was in fact a German immigrant who employed German immigrant workers, and they worked more than 10 hours per day. And this was in violation of the statute. None of the workers seemed to complain. That's why the case is Lochner versus New York, but what happened is the state decided to punish him criminally for exploiting a series of workers in question. And the issue was whether or not they could justify this particular regulation on grounds of health. And what happens is there is in all of these cases the following very important dichotomy, which is it's stated to be for health, but it may be to suppress competition. And in this particular case, we're pretty confident that the suppression of competition was the dominant element, because if you look at the rest of the statute, it contains provisions which talk about the requirements for adequate ventilation on sleeping quarters. And what happened in the Lochner case is that the non-union bakers slept on the job, so they worked more than 10 hours a day. The union bakers did not. And what therefore happened is when you put this 10-hour-a-day work rule into place, the union bakers would in fact be able to survive and the non-union bakers would be driven out of business. And when the Supreme Court struck this thing down, what they were trying to do in effect was to create a level playing field between two different forms of industrial organization, at which point the unions would run into rough sledding because the competition from outside would deprive them of their monopoly rents or the opportunities to acquire them. And the thing to understand about this case is it's exactly the same case analytically as the property case that I talked about before. Just imagine eight union guys on the outside and this non-union guy sitting in the middle. And what they all do is they agree to a regulation that says that nobody can work for 10 hours a day or more. And eight of these guys are perfectly content with the restriction and the ninth one is wiped out. That's exactly the same thing that you did with respect to the land use restriction, and it's the disproportionate impact, which is the dead clue that something's wrong, and the argument is, well, this was designed to protect the health, and Justice Peckham said, whose health? Nobody said that the bread was bad. Nobody said that the bakers were dying. Whose health are you protecting? Please tell me. Well, that, in effect, was a powerful argument, and you have to understand just how far it goes. If, in fact, you take the position that labor contracts are immune from government supervision, unless you could find a powerful health justification for either workers or customers to do so, you can't have minimum wage laws, hard to have any maximum hours laws, you can't have mandatory bargaining and collective unionization laws, but you can have unions if they can organize and persuade an employer, God bless them, and so forth, and so on. He's telling me 1 minute. So that's essentially the way in which the system starts to break. And if I had more time, which I do not, and I respect the orders of the court, I would talk about the federalism kinds of issues which some of you have asked about, and quite simply say this. the early 19th century, essentially when it looked at the powers of Congress to regulate commerce, said, we think you can regulate commerce to the extent that you open up borders on various state lines and facilitate the creation of a national market. By the time we got to the Commerce Clause in the New Deal period, it was completely inverted. What I have said, in effect, is that the traditional classical model was a little bit uneasy about how it dealt with private monopolies, but was dead opposed to the creation of state cartels, which backed, in effect, monopoly structures with state powers. That's the ultimate sin. It is no accident that if you look at the cases which result in the expansion of the commerce power to give the federal government plenary power to regulate essentially every economic activity under the sun, not to create competitive markets, you will find that they did so in two cases, one to rig national agricultural markets and the other to create mandatory collective bargaining systems under the National Labor Relations Act. So if you're trying to figure out structurally what it is that accounts for the sort of change in attitude, let me just put it to you this particular way. The old Lockean synthesis, when you get to the root of it, was essentially one that says you want as much government as is necessary, but no more, to create competitive markets on top of some kind of state coercive system. The modern view says, why do you want to stop with competition? If it's good, then state monopolies are great. And if the legislature wants to, in effect, empower certain individuals to wipe out their rivals, they're able to do so. Once you have that political dynamic, you have got a wealth destruction machinery in place, which can, in fact, do exactly what it was that that particular title to my lecture said, result in the massive contraction of liberties, the massive expansion of government. And it's a true national tragedy when somebody who calls himself a Republican in fact performs on this particular issue far worse than that other Democrat whom he happened to replace. Thank you.